of Razda. Crinton knocked twice, as instructed. A gruff voice answered through the door, growling something unintelligible in the mongrel tongue of Slaver's Bay, an ugly blend of old Gascari and High Valerian. The prince answered in the same tongue. Freedom! The door opened. Garrus entered first, for caution's sake, with Quentin close behind him, and the big man bringing up the rear. Within, the air was hazy with bluish smoke, whose sweet smell could not quite cover up the deeper stinks of piss and sour wine and rotting meat. The space was much larger than it had seemed from without, stretching off to right and left into the adjoining hovels. What had appeared to be a dozen structures from the street turned into one long hall inside. At this hour, the house was less than half full. A few of the patrons favoured the Dornish men with looks bored or hostile or curious. The rest were crowded around the pit at the far end of the room, where a pair of naked men were slashing at each other with knives, whilst the watchers cheered them on. Quentin saw no sign of the men they had come to meet. Then a door he had not seen before swung open, and an old woman emerged, a shriveled thing in a dark red toga fringed with tiny golden skulls. Her skin was white as mare's milk, her hair so thin that he could see the scalp beneath.
"Dawn," she said, "I be your Serena, purple lotus. Go down here, you find them."
She held the door and gestured them through. Beyond was a flight of wooden steps, steep and twisting. This time the big man led the way, and Garrus was the rear guard, with the prince between them. An undercellar! It was a long way down, and so dark that Quentin had to feel his way to keep from slipping. Near the bottom, Sir Archibald pulled his dagger. They emerged in a brick vault, thrice the size of the wine sink above. Huge wooden vats lined the walls as far as the prince could see. A red lantern hung on a hook just inside the door, and a greasy black candle flickered on an overturned barrel, serving as a table. That was the only light. Cago Corpsekiller was pacing by wine vats, his black arrack hanging at his hip. Pretty Maris stood cradling a crossbow, her eyes as cold and dead as two grey stones. Denzo Dan barred the door once the Dornishmen were inside, then took up a position in front of it, arms crossed against his chest. One too many, Quentin thought. The tattered prince himself was seated at the table, nursing a cup of wine. In the yellow candlelight, his silver-grey hair seemed almost golden, though the pouches underneath his eyes were etched as large as saddlebags. He wore a brown wool traveller's cloak, with silvery chainmail glimmering underneath. Did that betoken treachery or simple prudence? "An old sellsword is a cautious sellsword." Quentin approached his table. "My lord, you look different without your cloak."
"My ragged raiment." The Pentoshi gave a shrug. "A poor thing. Yet those tatters fill my foes with fear. And on the battlefield the sight of my rags blowing in the wind emboldens my men more than any banner. And if I want to move unseen, I need only slip it off to become plain and unremarkable."
He gestured at the bench across from him.
"Sit. I understand that you are a prince. Would that I had known. Will you drink? Tsarina offers food as well. Her bread is stale and her stew is unspeakable. Grease and salt, with a morsel or two of meat. Dog, she says, but I think rat is more likely. It will not kill you, though. I've found that it is only when the food is tempting that one must beware. Poisoners invariably choose the choicest dishes."
"You brought three men," Sir Garrus pointed out, with an edge in his voice.
"We agreed on two apiece."
"Maris is no man. Maris, sweet, undo your shirt. Show him."
"That will not be necessary," said Quentin.
If the talk he had heard was true, beneath that shirt, pretty Merris had only the scars left by the men who'd cut her breasts off. Merris as a woman, I agree. You've still twisted the terms. Tattered and twisty. What a rogue I am. 3-2 is not much of an advantage, it must be admitted, but it counts for something. In this world, a man must learn to seize whatever gifts the gods chose to send him. That was a lesson I learned at some cost. I offer it to you as a sign of my good faith. He gestured at the chair again. Sit and say what you came to say. I promise not to have you killed until I've heard you out. That is the least I can do for a fellow prince. Quentin, is it?
Quentin, of House Martell.
Frog suits you better. It is not my custom to drink with liars and deserters, but you've made me curious.
Quentin sat. One wrong word and this could turn to blood in half a heartbeat.
I ask your pardon for our deception. The only ship sailing for Slaver's Bay were those that had been hired to bring you to the wars.
The tattered prince gave a shrug.
Every turncloak has his tail. You are not the first to swear me your swords, take my coin, and run. All of them have reasons. My little son is sick, or my wife is putting horns on me, or the other men all make me suck their cocks. Such a charming boy at the last, but I did not excuse his desertion. Another fellow told me our food was so wretched that he had to flee before it made him sick, so I had his foot cut off, roasted it up, and fed it to him. Then I made him our camp cook. Our meals improved markedly, and when his contract was fulfilled, he signed another. You, though, several of my best are locked up in the Queen's dungeons, thanks to that lying tongue of yours. And I doubt that you can even cook.
I am a Prince of Dorne, said Quentin. I had a duty to my father and my people. There was a secret marriage pact.
So I heard. And when the Silver Queen saw your scrap of parchment, she fell into your arms, yes?
No, said Pretty Merris.
No? Oh, I recall. Your bride flew off on a dragon. Well, when she returns, do be sure to invite us to your nuptials. The men of the company would love to drink to your happiness. And I do love a Westerosi wedding. The bedding part especially, only... Oh, wait!
He turned to Denzo Dan.
Denzo, I thought you told me that the Dragon Queen had married some Gascari. A Meranese nobleman. Rich.
The tattered prince turned back to Quentin.
Could that be true? Oh, surely not. What of your marriage pact?
She laughed at him, said Pretty Merris.
Daenerys never laughed. The rest of Meereen might see him as an amusing curiosity, like the exiled summer islander that King Robert used to keep at King's Landing, but the Queen had always spoken to him gently.
We came too late, said Quentin.
A pity you did not desert me sooner.
The tattered prince sipped at his wine.
So, no wedding for Prince Frog. Is that why you come hopping back to me? Have my three brave Dornish lads decided to honour their contracts?
No.
How vexing. Yerkazo Yunsak is dead. Ancient tidings. I saw him die. The poor man saw a dragon and stumbled as he tried to flee. Then 1,000 of his closest friends stepped on him. No doubt the Yellow City is awash in tears. Did you ask me here to toast his memory?
No. Have the Yunkishmen chosen a new commander?
The Council of Masters has been unable to agree. Yezanzo Kagas had the most support, but now he's died as well.
The wise masters are rotating their supreme command amongst themselves. Today our leader is one of your friends, in the ranks, dubbed the Drunken Conqueror. On the morrow it will be Lord Wobblecheeks.
The rabbit, said Maris. Wobblecheeks was yesterday.
I stand corrected, my sweetling. Our youngish friends were kind enough to provide us with a chart. I must strive to be more assiduous about consulting it. Yerkaz Zoyanzak was a man who hired you. He signed our contract on behalf of his city, just so. Mirin and Yunkai have made peace. The siege is to be lifted. The army is disbanded. There will be no battle, no slaughter, no city to sack and plunder. Oh, life is full of disappointments. How long do you think the Yunkishmen will want to continue paying wages to four free companies?
The tattered prince took a sip of wine and said,
A vexing question. But this is the way of life for we men of the free companies. One war ends, another begins. Fortunately, there's always someone fighting someone somewhere, perhaps here, even as we sit here drinking. Bloodbeard is urging our youngish friends to present King Hisdar with another head. Freedmen and slavers eye each other's necks and sharpen their knives. The sons of the Harpy plot in their pyramids. The pale mare rides down slave and lord alike. Our friends from the Yellow City gaze out to sea, and somewhere in the grasslands a dragon nibbles the tender flesh of Daenerys Targaryen. Who rules Meereen tonight? Who will rule it on the morrow? Then Pentoshe gave a shrug. One thing I am certain of. Someone will have need of our swords. I have need of those swords. Dorne will hire you. The tattered prince glanced at Pretty Maris. He does not lack for gall, this frog. Must I remind him? My dear prince, the last contract we signed, you used to wipe your pretty pink bottom. I will double whatever the Yunkishmen are paying you. And pay in gold upon the signing of our contract, yes? I will pay you part when we reach Volantis. The rest when I am back in Sunspear. We brought gold with us when we set sail, but it would have been hard to conceal once we joined the company, so we gave it over to the banks. I can show you papers.
Ah, papers. But we will be paid double.
Twice as many papers, said Pretty Maris.
The rest you'll have in Dorne, Quentin insisted. My father is a man of honor. If I put my seal to an agreement, he will fulfill its terms. You have my word on that.
The tattered prince finished his wine, turned the cup over, and set it down between them.
So, let me see if I understand. A proven liar and oathbreaker wishes to contract with us and pay in promises. And for what services, I wonder? Am I wind-blown to smash the Yunkai and sack the Yellow City? Defeat a Dothraki Khalasar in the field? Escort you home to your father? Or will you be content if we deliver Queen Daenerys to your bed, wet and willing? Tell me true, Prince Frog, what would you have of me and mine? I need you to help me steal a dragon. Kago Corpskiller chuckled. Pretty Maris curled her lip in a half-smile. Denzo Dan whistled. The tattered prince only leaned back on his stool and said, Double does not pay for dragons, princeling. Even a frog should know that much. Dragons come dear, and men who pay in promises should have at least the sense to promise more. If you want me to triple what I want, said the tattered prince, is Pentos.
Tyrion,
The new crown that his father had given the Faith stood twice as tall as the one the mob had smashed, a glory of crystal and spun gold. Rainbow light flashed and shimmered every time the High Septon moved his head, but Tyrion had to wonder how the man could bear the weight. And even he had to concede that Joffrey and Margaery made a regal couple as they stood side by side between the towering gilded statues of the father and the mother. The bride was lovely in ivory silk and Moorish lace, her skirts decorated with floral patterns picked out in seed pearls. As Renly's widow, she might have worn the Baratheon colours, gold and black, yet she came to them a Tyrell, in a maiden's cloak made of 100 cloth of gold roses sewn to green velvet. He wondered if she really was a maiden. Not that Joffrey is like to know the difference. The king looked near as splendid as his bride, in his doublet of dusky rose beneath a cloak of deep crimson velvet blazoned with his stag and lion. The crown rested easily on his curls, gold on gold. I save that bloody crown for him. Tyrion shifted his weight uncomfortably from one foot to the other. He could not stand still. Too much wine. He should have thought to relieve himself before they had set out from the Red Keep. The sleepless night he'd spent with Shay was making itself felt too, but most of all he wanted to strangle his bloody royal nephew. "I am no stranger to Valyrian steel," the boy had boasted. The Septons were always going on about how the Father above judges us all. If the Father would be so good as to topple over and crush Joff like a dung beetle, I might even believe it. He ought to have seen it long ago. Jaime would never send another man to do his killing, and Cersei was too cunning to use a knife that could be traced back to her. But Joff, arrogant, vicious, stupid little wretch that he was... He remembered a cold morning when he'd climbed down the steep exterior steps from Winterfell's library to find Prince Joffrey jesting with a hound about killing wolves. "Send a dog to kill a wolf," he said. Even Joffrey was not so foolish as to command Sandor Clegane to slay a son of Eddard Stark, however. The hound would have gone to Cersei. Instead, the boy found his cat's paw among the unsavory lot of free riders, merchants, and camp followers who detached themselves to the king's party as they made their way north. "Some poxy lackwit, willing to risk his life for a prince's favour and a little coin." Tyrion wondered whose idea it had been to wait until Robert left Winterfell before opening Bran's throat. Joff's, most like. No doubt he thought it was the height of cunning. The prince's own dagger had a jewelled pommel and inlaid goldwork on the blade, Tyrion seemed to recall. At least Joff had not been stupid enough to use that. Instead, he went poking among his father's weapons. Robert Baratheon was a man of careless generosity, and would have given his son any dagger he wanted. But Tyrion guessed that the boy had just taken it. Robert had come to Winterfell with a long tail of knights and retainers, a huge wheelhouse and a baggage train. No doubt some diligent servant had made certain that the king's weapons went with him, in case he should desire any of them. The blade Joff chose was nice and plain. No gold work, no jewels in the hilt, no silver inlay on the blade. King Robert never wore it, had likely forgotten he owned it. Yet the Valyrian steel was deadly sharp, sharp enough to slice through skin, flesh, and muscle in one quick stroke. "I am no stranger to Valyrian steel." But he had been, hadn't he? Else he would never have been so foolish as to pick Littlefinger's knife. The why of it still eluded him. Simple cruelty, perhaps. His nephew had that in abundance. It was all Tyrion could do not to retch up all the wine he'd drunk, piss in his breeches, or both. He squirmed uncomfortably. He ought to have held his tongue at breakfast. "The boy knows I know now. My big mouth will be the death of me, I swear it." The seven vows were made, the seven blessings invoked, and the seven promises exchanged. When the wedding song had been sung, and the challenge had gone unanswered, it was time for the exchange of cloaks. Tyrion shifted his weight from one stunted leg to the other, trying to see between his father and his uncle Kevin. "If the gods are just, Joff will make a hash of this." He made certain not to look at Sansa, lest his bitterness show in his eyes. "You might have knelt, damn you. Would it have been so bloody hard to bend those stiff, stark knees of yours, and let me keep a little dignity?" Mace Tyrell removed his daughter's maiden cloak tenderly, while Joffrey accepted the folded bride's cloak from his brother, Tommen, and shook it out with a flourish. The boy king was as tall at 13 as his bride was at 16. He would not require a fool's back to climb upon. He draped Margaery in the crimson and gold and leaned close to fasten it at her throat. And that easily she passed from her father's protection to her husband's. "But who will protect her from Joff?" Tyrion glanced at the Knight of Flowers standing with the other king's guard. "You had best keep your sword well honed, Sir Loras."
"With this kiss I pledge my love,"
Joffrey declared in ringing tones. When Margaery echoed the words, he pulled her close and kissed her long and deep. Rainbow lights danced once more about the High Septon's crown as he solemnly declared Joffrey of the Houses Baratheon and Lannister and Margaery of House Tyrell to be one flesh, one heart, one soul.
"Good, that's done with. Now let's get back to the bloody castle so I can have a piss."
Sir Loras and Sir Meryn led the procession from the sept in their white scale armour and snowy cloaks. Then came Prince Tommen, scattering rose petals from a basket before the king and queen. After the royal couple followed Queen Cersei and Lord Tyrell, then the bride's mother arm in arm with Lord Tywin. The Queen of Thorns tottered after them, with one hand on Sir Kevin Lannister's arm and the other on her cane, her twin guardsmen close behind her in case she fell. Next came Sir Garland Tyrell and his lady wife, and finally it was their turn.
"My lady,"
Tyrion offered Sansa his arm. She took it, dutifully, but he could feel her stiffness as they walked up the aisle together. She never once looked down at him. He heard them cheering outside even before he reached the doors. The mob loved Margaery so much they were even willing to love Joffrey again. She had belonged to Renly, the handsome young prince who had loved them so well. He had come back from beyond the grave to save them. And the bounty of Highgarden had come with her, flowing up the Rose Road from the south. The fools didn't seem to remember that it had been Mace Tyrell who closed the Rose Road to begin with and made the bloody famine. They stepped out into the crisp autumn air.
"I feared we'd never escape,"
Tyrion quipped. Sansa had no choice but to look at him then.
Yes, my lord, as you say."
She looked sad.
"It was such a beautiful ceremony, though."
"As ours was not."
"It was long, I'll say that much. I need to return to the castle for a good piss."
Tyrion rubbed the stump of his nose.
"Would that I'd contrive some mission to take me out of the city." Littlefinger was the clever one.
Joffrey and Margaery stood surrounded by King's Guard atop the steps that fronted on the broad marble plaza. Sir Adam and his gold cloaks held back the crowd, while the statue of King Baelor the Blessed gazed down on them benevolently. Tyrion had no choice but to queue up with the rest to offer congratulations. He kissed Margaery's fingers and wished her every happiness. Thankfully, there were others behind them, waiting their turn, so they did not need to linger long. Their litter had been sitting in the sun, and it was very warm inside the curtains. As they lurched into motion, Tyrion reclined on an elbow while Sansa sat staring at her hands.
"She is just as comely as a Tyrell girl," Her hair was a rich autumn auburn, her eyes a deep tully blue. Grief had given her a haunted, vulnerable look. If anything, it had only made her more beautiful. He wanted to reach her, to break through the armor of her courtesy. Was that what made him speak? Or just the need to distract himself from the fullness in his bladder?
I had been thinking that when the roads are safe again, we might journey to Casterly Rock,
far from Geoffrey and my sister. The more he thought about what Geoff had done to Lives of Four Kings, the more it troubled him.
There was a message there.
Oh, yes.
It would please me to show you the Golden Gallery and the Lion's Mouth and the Hall of Heroes, where Jamie and I played as boys. You can hear thunder from below where the sea comes in.
She raised her head slowly. He knew what she was seeing, the swollen, brutish brow, the raw stump of his nose, his crooked pink scar and mismatched eyes. Her own eyes were big and blue and empty.
I shall go wherever my lord husband wishes. I had hoped it might please you, my lady. It will please me to please my lord.
His mouth tightened.
What a pathetic little man you are. Did you think babbling about the Lion's Mouth would make her smile? When have you ever made a woman smile but with gold? No, it was a foolish notion. Only a Lannister can love the rock.
Yes, my lord, as you wish.
Tyrion could hear the commons shouting out King Joffrey's name. In 3 years that cruel boy will be a man ruling in his own right, and every dwarf with half his wits will be a long way from King's Landing. Old Town, perhaps, or even the Free Cities. He'd always had a yen to see the Titan of Braavos.
Perhaps that would please Sansa.
Gently he spoke of Braavos, and met a wall of sullen courtesy, as icy and unyielding as the wall he had once walked in the north. It made him weary, then and now.
They passed the rest of the journey in silence. After a while, Tyrion found himself hoping that Sansa would say something, anything, the merest word. But she never spoke. When the litter halted in the castle yard, he let one of the grooms help her down.
"We will be expected at the feast an hour hence, my lady. I will join you shortly."
He walked off, stiff-legged. Across the yard he could hear Marjorie's breathless laugh as Joffrey swept her from the saddle. "The boy will be as tall and strong as Jamie one day," he thought. "And I'll still be a dwarf beneath his feet. And one day, he's like to make me even shorter."
He found a privy and sighed gratefully as he relieved himself of the morning's wine. There were times when a piss felt near as good as a woman, and this was one. He wished he could relieve himself of his doubts and guilts half as easily. Podrick Payne was waiting outside his chambers.
"I laid out your new doublet, not here, on your bed, in the bedchamber."
"Yes, that's where we keep the bed."
Sansa would be in there, dressing for the feast.
She as well.
"Wine, Pod."
Tyrion drank it in his window seat, brooding over the chaos of the kitchens below. The sun had not yet touched the top of the castle wall, but he could smell breads baking and meats roasting. The guests would soon be pouring into the throne room, full of anticipation. This would be an evening of song and splendour, designed not only to unite Highgarden and Castle Rock, but to trumpet their power and wealth as a lesson to any who might still think to oppose Joffrey's rule. But who would be mad enough to contest Joffrey's rule now, after what had befallen Stannis Baratheon and Robb Stark? There was still fighting in the Riverlands, but everywhere the coils were tightening. Sir Gregor Clegane had crossed the Trident and seized the Ruby Ford, then captured Harrenhal almost effortlessly. Seagard had yielded to Blackwalder Frey. Lord Randall Tarly held Maidenpool,
Duskendale, and the King's Road. In the west, Sir Devon Lannister had linked up with Sir Fawley Prester at the Golden Tooth for a march on Riverrun. Sir Raymond Frey was leading 2,000 spears down from the Twins to join them, and Paxter Redwine claimed his fleet would soon set sail from the arbour to begin the long voyage around Dawn and through the Stepstones. Stannis's Lyseni pirates would be outnumbered 10-1. The struggle that the Maesters were calling the War of the Five Kings was all but at an end. Mace Tyrell had been heard complaining that Lord Tywin had left no victories for him.
"My lord," Pod was at his side, "will you be changing? I laid out the doublet on your bed for the feast."
"Feast?" said Tyrion sourly. "What feast?"
"The wedding feast."
Pod missed the sarcasm, of course.
"King Joffrey and Lady Margaery. Queen Margaery, I mean."
Tyrion resolved to get very, very drunk tonight. "Very well, young Podrick. Let's go make me festive."
Shay was helping Sansa with her hair when they entered the bedchamber. Joy and grief, he thought when he beheld them there together. Laughter and tears. Sansa wore a gown of silvery satin trimmed in vair, with dagged sleeves that almost touched the floor, lined in soft purple felt. Shay had arranged her hair artfully in a delicate silver net winking with dark purple gemstones. Tyrion had never seen her look more lovely. Yet she wore sorrow on those long satin sleeves.
"Lady Sansa," he told her, "you shall be the most beautiful woman in the hall tonight."
"My lord is too kind."
"My lady," said Shay wistfully, "couldn't I come serve at table? I so want to see the pigeons fly out of the pie."
Sansa looked at her uncertainly. "The queen has chosen all the servers."
"And the hall will be too crowded." Tyrion had to bite back his annoyance. "There will be musicians strolling all through the castle, though, and tables in the outer ward with food and drink for all."
He inspected his new doublet, crimson velvet with padded shoulders and puff sleeves slashed to show the black satin underlining.
"A handsome garment, all at once, is a handsome man to wear it.
Come, Pod, help me into this."
He had another cup of wine as he dressed. Then he took his wife by the arm and escorted her from the kitchen keep to join the river of silk, satin and velvet flowing toward the throne room. Some guests had gone inside to find their places on the benches. Others were milling in front of the doors, enjoying the unseasonable warmth of the afternoon. Tyrion led Sansa around the yard to perform the necessary courtesies.
"She is good at this," he thought, as he watched her tell Lord Giles that his cough was sounding better, compliment Eleanor Tyrell on her gown, and question Jalabar Zo about wedding customs in the Summer Isles. His cousin, Sir Lancel, had been brought down by Sir Kevin, the first time he'd left his sickbed since the battle. "He looks ghastly." Lancel's hair had turned white and brittle, and he was thin as a stick. Without his father beside him, holding him up, he would surely have collapsed. Yet when Sansa praised his valour and said how good it was to see him getting strong again, both Lancel and Sir Kevin beamed.
"She would have made Joffrey a good queen, and a better wife, if he'd had the sense to love her."
He wondered if his nephew was capable of loving anyone.
"You do look quite exquisite, child," Lady Olenna Tyrell told Sansa when she tottered up to them in a cloth of gold gown that must have weighed more than she did. "The wind has been at your hair, though."
The little old woman reached up and fussed at the loose strands, tucking them back into place and straightening Sansa's hairnet.
"I was very sorry to hear about your losses," she said as she tugged and fiddled. "Your brother was a terrible traitor, I know, but if we start killing men at weddings, they'll be even more frightened of marriage than they are presently. There, that's better.
Lady Olenna smiled.
I'm pleased to say I shall be leaving for High Garden the day after next. I've had quite enough of this smelly city, thank you. Perhaps you would like to accompany me for a little visit while the men are off having their war. I shall miss my Margery so dreadfully, and all her lovely ladies. Your company would be such sweet solace.
You are too kind, my lady, said Sansa, but my place is with my lord husband. Lady Olenna gave Tyrion a wrinkled, toothless smile.
Oh, forgive me, a silly old woman, my lord. I did not mean to steal your lovely wife. I assumed you would be off leading a Lannister host against some wicked foe.
A host of dragons and stags. The master of coin must remain at court to see that all the armies are paid for.
To be sure. Dragons and stags, eh? Oh, that is very clever. And dwarfs' pennies as well. I've heard of these dwarfs' pennies. No doubt collecting those is such a dreadful chore.
I leave the collecting to others, my lady.
Oh, do ye? I would have thought you might want to tend to it yourself. We can't have the crown being cheated of its dwarfs' pennies now, can we?
Gods forbid.
Tyrion was beginning to wonder whether Lord Luther Tyrell had ridden off that cliff intentionally.
If you will excuse us, Lady Olenna, it is time we were in our places.
Myself as well. 77 courses, I dare say. Don't you find that a bit excessive, my lord? I shan't eat more than 3 or 4 bites myself, but you and I are very little, aren't we?
She patted Sansa's hair again and said,
Well, off with you, child, and try to be merrier. Now, where have my guardsmen gone? Left, right? Where are you? Come, help me to the dais.
Although Evenfor was still an hour away, the throne room was already a blaze of light, with torches burning in every sconce. The guests stood along the tables as heralds called out the names and titles of the lords and ladies making their entrance. Pages in the royal livery escorted them down the broad central aisle. The gallery above was packed with musicians. Drummers and pipers and fiddlers, strings and horns and skins. Tyrion clutched Sansa's arm and made the walk with a heavy, waddling stride. He could feel their eyes on him, picking at the fresh new scar that had left him even uglier than he had been before.
Let them look, he thought, as he hopped up onto his seat. Let them stare and whisper till they've had their fill. I will not hide myself for their sake.
The Queen of Thorns followed them in, shuffling along with tiny little steps. Tyrion wondered which of them looked more absurd, him with Sansa, or the wizened little woman between her 7-foot-tall twin guardsmen. Joffrey and Margery rode into the throne room on matched white chargers. Pages ran before them, scattering rose petals under their hooves. The king and queen had changed for the feast as well. Joffrey wore striped black and crimson breeches and a cloth of gold doublet with black satin sleeves and onyx studs. Margery had exchanged the demure gown that she had worn in the sept for one much more revealing, a confection in pale green samite with a tight-laced bodice that bared her shoulders and the tops of her small breasts. Unbound, her soft brown hair tumbled over her white shoulders and down her back almost to her waist. Around her brows was a slim golden crown. Her smile was shy and sweet. A lovely girl, thought Tyrion, and a kinder fate than my nephew deserves. The king's guard escorted them onto the dais to the seats of honour beneath the shadow of the iron throne, draped for the occasion in long silken streamers of Baratheon gold, Lannister crimson, and Tyrell green. Cersei embraced Margery and kissed her cheeks. Lord Tywin did the same, and then Lancel and Sir Kevin. Joffrey received loving kisses from the bride's father and his two new brothers, Loras and Garlan. No one seemed in any great rush to kiss Tyrion. When the king and queen had taken their seats, the High Septon rose to lead a prayer. "At least he does not drone as badly as the last one," Tyrion consoled himself. He and Sansa had been seated far to the king's right, beside Sir Garlan Tyrell and his wife, the Lady Lyonette. A dozen others sat closer to Joffrey, which a pricklier man might have taken for a slight, given that he had been the king's hand only a short time past. Tyrion would have been glad if there had been 100.
"Let the cups be filled," Joffrey proclaimed, when the guards had been given their due.
His cupbearer poured a whole flagon of dark arbor red into the golden wedding chalice that Lord Tyrell had given him that morning. The king had to use both hands to lift it.
"To my wife, the queen."
"Margaery!"
The hall shouted back at him. "Margaery! Margaery! To the queen!" 1,000 cups rang together, and the wedding feast was well and truly begun. Tyrion Lannister drank with the rest, emptying his cup on that first toast and signalling for it to be refilled as soon as he was seated again. The first dish was a creamy soup of mushrooms and buttered snails served in gilded bowls. Tyrion had scarcely touched the breakfast, and the wine had already gone to his head, so the food was welcome. He finished quickly.
"One done, 76 to come. 77 dishes, while there are still starving children in the city, and men who would kill for a radish. They might not love the Tyrells half so well if they could see us now."
Sansa tasted a spoonful of soup and pushed the bowl away.
"Not to your liking, my lady?"
Tyrion asked.
"There's to be so much, my lord. I have a little tummy." She fiddled nervously with her hair and looked down the table to where Joffrey sat with his Tyrell queen. "Does she wish it were her in Margaery's place?"
Tyrion frowned.
"Even a child should have better sense."
He turned away, wanting distraction. But everywhere he looked were women, fair, fine, beautiful, happy women who belonged to other men. Margaery, of course, smiling sweetly as she and Joffrey shared a drink from the great seven-sided wedding chalice. Her mother, Lady Illyria, silver-haired and handsome, still proud beside Mace Tyrell. The queen's three young cousins, bright as birds. Lord Merryweather's dark-haired, Moorish wife, with the big black sultry eyes. Ilaria Sand among the Dornishmen. Cersei had placed them at their own table, just below the dais, in a place of high honour, but as far from the Tyrells as the width of the hall would allow, laughing at something the Red Viper had told her. And there was one woman, sitting almost at the foot of the third table on the left, the wife of one of the Fosseways, he thought, and heavy with his child. Her delicate beauty was in no way diminished by her belly, nor was her pleasure in the food and frolics. Tyrion watched as her husband fed her morsels off his plate. They drank from the same cup and would kiss often and unpredictably. Whenever they did, his hand would gently rest upon her stomach, a tender and protective gesture. He wondered what Sansa would do if he leaned over and kissed her right now.
Flinch away, most likely,
or be brave and suffer through it, as was her duty.
She is nothing if not dutiful, this wife of mine.
If he told her that he wished to have her maidenhead tonight, she would suffer that dutifully as well, and weep no more than she had to. He called for more wine. By the time he got it, the second course was being served, a pastry coffin filled with pork, pine nuts, and eggs. Sansa ate no more than a bite of hers, as the heralds were summoning the first of the seven singers. Greybeard Hamish the Harper announced that he would perform,
"For the ears of gods and men, a song
ne'er had before in all the Seven Kingdoms. He called it Lord Renly's Raid.
His fingers moved across the strings of the high harp, filling the throne room with sweet sound.
From his throne of bones, the Lord of Death looked down on the murdered lord.
Hamish began, and went on to tell how Renly, repenting his attempt to usurp his nephew's crown, had defied the Lord of Death himself and crossed back to the land of the living to defend the realm against his brother.
And for this, poor Simon wound up in a bowl of brown, Tyrion mused.
Queen Marjorie was teary-eyed by the end, when the shade of brave Lord Renly flew to Highgarden to steal one last look at his true love's face.
Renly Baratheon never repented of anything in his life, the imp told Sansa. But if I'm any judge, Hamish has just won himself a gilded lute.
The harper also gave them several more familiar songs. A Rose of Gold was for the Tyrells, no doubt, as the Reigns of Castamere was meant to flatter his father. Maiden, Mother, and Crone delighted the High Septon, and My Lady Wife pleased all the little girls with romance in their hearts, and no doubt some little boys as well. Tyrion listened with half an ear as he sampled sweet corn fritters and hot oat bread baked with bits of date, apple, and orange, and gnawed on the rib of a wild boar. Thereafter, dishes and diversions succeeded one another in a staggering profusion, buoyed along upon a flood of wine and ale. Hamish left them, his place taken by a smallish, elderly bear who danced clumsily to the pipe and drum, whilst the wedding guests ate trout cooked in a crust of crushed almonds. Moonboy mounted his stilts and strode around the tables in pursuit of Lord Tyrell's ludicrously fatful butterbumps, and the lords and ladies sampled roast herons and cheese and onion pies. A troop of Pentoshi tumblers performed cartwheels and handstands, balanced platters on their bare feet, and stood upon each other's shoulders to form a pyramid. Their feats were accompanied by crabs boiled in fiery eastern spices, trenchers filled with chunks of chopped mutton, stewed in almond milk with carrots, raisins, and onions, and fish tarts fresh from the ovens served so hot they burned the fingers. Then the herald summoned another singer, Caliur Canis of Tyrosh, who had a vermilion beard and an accent as ludicrous as Simon had promised. Caliur began with his version of The Dance of the Dragons, which was more properly a song for two singers, male and female. Tyrion suffered through it with a double helping of honey, ginger, partridge, and several cups of wine. A haunting ballad of two dying lovers amidst the doom of Valyria might have pleased the hall more if Caliur had not sung it in High Valyrian, which most of the guests could not speak. But Besser the barmaid won them back with its ribald lyrics. Peacocks were served in their plumage, roasted whole and stuffed with dates, while Caliur summoned a drummer, bowed low before Lord Tywin, and launched into the Reigns of Castamere.
If I have to hear seven versions of that, I may go down to Flea Bottom and apologize to the stew.
Tyrion turned to his wife.
So, which did you prefer?
Sansa blinked at him.
My lord?
The singers. Which did you prefer?
I'm sorry, my lord. I was not listening.
She was not eating either.
Sansa, is aught amiss?
He spoke without thinking, and instantly felt the fool.
All her kin are slaughtered, and she's wed to me, and I wonder what's amiss.
No, my lord.
She looked away from him, and feigned an unconvincing interest in Moonboy pelting Sir Dontus with dates. Four master pyromancers conjured up beasts of living flame to tear at each other with fiery claws, whilst the serving men ladled out bowls of blendisserie, a mixture of beef broth and boiled wine sweetened with honey and dotted with blanched almonds and chunks of capon. Then came some strolling pipers and clever dogs and sword swallowers, with buttered peas, chopped nuts, and slivers of swan poached in a sauce of saffron and peaches. "Not swan again," Tyrion muttered, remembering his supper with his sister on the eve of battle. A juggler kept half a dozen swords and axes whirling through the air, as skewers of blood sausage were brought sizzling to the tables, a juxtaposition that Tyrion thought passing clever, though not perhaps in the best of taste. The heralds blew their trumpets. "To sing for the golden lute," one cried. "We give you Galeon of Kai." Galeon was a big barrel-chested man with a black beard, a bald head, and a thunderous voice that filled every corner of the throne room. He brought no fewer than 6 musicians to play for him.
"Noble lords and ladies fair, I sing but one song for you this night," he announced. "It is the song of the Black Warder and how Realmor was saved."
The drummer began a slow, ominous beat.
"The Dark Lord brooded high in his tower," Galeon began, "in a castle as black as the night."
Black was his hair and black was his soul, the musicians chanted in unison. A flute came in.
"He feasted on bloodlust and envy, and filled his cup full up with spite,"
sang Galeon.
"My brother wants your 7 kingdoms," he said to his harridan wife. "I'll take what was his and make it all mine. Let his son feel the point of my knife."
"A brave young boy with a hair of gold," his players chanted as a woodharp and a fiddle began to play.
"If I am ever hand again, the first thing I'll do is hang all the singers," said Tyrion too loudly.
Lady Leonette laughed lightly beside him, and Sir Garlon leaned over to say,
"Valiant deed on song is no less valiant."
"The Dark Lord assembled his legions. They gathered around him like crows, and thirsty for blood, they boarded their ships."
"And cut off poor Tyrion's nose,"
Tyrion finished.
Lady Leonette giggled. "Perhaps you should be a singer, my lord. You rhyme as well as this Galeon."
"No, my lady," Sir Garlon said. "My lord of Lannister was made to do great deeds, not to sing of them. But for his chain and his wildfire, the foe would have been across the river. And if Tyrion's wildlings had not slain most of Lord Stannis' scouts, we would never have been able to take him unawares." His words made Tyrion feel absurdly grateful, and helped to mollify him as Galeon sang endless verses about the valour of the boy king and his mother, the Golden Queen.
"She never did that," Sansa blurted out suddenly. "Never believe anything you hear in a song, my lady."
Tyrion summoned a serving man to refill their wine cups. Soon it was full night outside the tall windows, and still Galeon sang on. His song had 77 verses, though it seemed more like 1,000.
"One for every guest in the hall."
Tyrion drank his way through the last 20 or so to help resist the urge to stuff mushrooms in his ears. By the time the singer had taken his bows, some of the guests were drunk enough to begin providing unintentional entertainments of their own. Grand Maester Pycelle fell asleep, while dancers from the summer isle swirled and spun in robes made of bright feathers and smoky silk. Rondels of elk stuffed with ripe blue cheese were being brought out when one of Lord Rowan's knights stabbed a Dornishman. The gold cloaks dragged them both away, one to a cell to rot and the other to get sewn up by Maester Balabar. Tyrion was toying with a lech of brawn spiced with cinnamon, clove, sugar, and almond milk, when King Joffrey lurched suddenly to his feet.
"Bring on my royal jousters," he shouted, in a voice thick with wine, clapping his hands together. "My nephew is drunker than I am," Tyrion thought, as the gold cloaks opened the great doors at the end of the hall. From where he sat, he could only see the tops of two striped lances as a pair of riders entered side by side. A wave of laughter followed them down the centre aisle toward the king. "They must be riding ponies," he concluded, until they came into full view. The jousters were a pair of dwarfs. One was mounted on an ugly grey dog, long of leg and heavy of jaw. The other rode an immense spotted sow. Painted wooden armour clattered and clacked as the little knights bounced up and down in their saddles. Their shields were bigger than they were, and they wrestled manfully with their lances as they clumped along, swaying this way and that, and eliciting gusts of mirth. One knight was all in gold, with a black stag painted on his shield. The other wore grey and white and bore a wolf device. Their mounts were barded likewise. Tyrion glanced along the dais at all the laughing faces. Joffrey was red and breathless. Tommen was hooting and hopping up and down in his seat. Cersei was chuckling politely, and even Lord Tywin looked mildly amused. Of all those at the high table, only Sansa Stark was not smiling. He could have loved her for that, but if truth be told, the Stark girl's eyes were far away, as if she had not even seen the ludicrous riders loping toward her. "The dwarfs are not to blame," Tyrion decided. "When they are done, I shall compliment them and give them a fat purse of silver. And come the morrow, I shall find whoever planned this little diversion and arrange for a different sort of thanks." When the dwarfs reined up beneath the dais to salute the king, the wolf knight dropped his shield. As he leaned over to grab for it, the stag knight lost control of his heavy lance and slammed him across the back. The wolf knight fell off his pig, and his lance tumbled over and boinked his foe on the head. They both wound up on the floor in a great tangle. When they rose, both tried to mount the dog. Much shouting and shoving followed. Finally, they regained their saddles, only mounted on each other's steed, holding the wrong shield and facing backward. It took some time to sort that out, but in the end they spurred to opposite ends of the hall and wheeled about for the tilt. As the lords and ladies guffawed and giggled, the little men came together with a crash and a clatter, and the wolf knight's lance struck the helm of the stag knight and knocked his head clean off. It spun through the air, spattering blood, to land in the lap of Lord Giles. The headless dwarf careened around the tables, flailing his arms. Dogs barked, women shrieked, and Moonboy made a great show of swaying perilously back and forth on his stilts, until Lord Giles pulled a dripping red melon out of the shattered helm, at which point the stag knight poked his face up out of his armour, and another storm of laughter rocked the hall. The knights waited for it to die, circled around each other, trading colourful insults, and were about to separate for another joust, when the dog threw its rider to the floor and mounted the sow. The huge pig squealed in distress, while the wedding guests squealed with laughter, especially when the stag knight leapt onto the wolf knight, let down his woolen breeches, and started to pump away frantically at the other's nether portions.
"I yield, I yield," the dwarf on the bottom screamed. "Good sir, put up your sword." I would, if you'll stop moving the sheath," the dwarf on the top replied, to the merriment of all. Joffrey was snorting wine from both nostrils. Gasping, he lurched to his feet, almost knocking over his tall two-handed chalice. "A champion!" he shouted. "We have a champion!" The hall began to quiet when it was seen that the king was speaking. The dwarfs untangled, no doubt anticipating the royal thanks. "Not a true champion, though," said Joff. "A true champion defeats all challengers." The king climbed up on the table.
Who else will challenge our tiny champion?
With a gleeful smile, he turned toward Tyrion.
Uncle, you'll defend the